This is Marla Herbig, The Black Virgin, March 15th, 1996.
Jung Society lectures on the soul, feminine aspects of the soul. Marla Herbig, The Archetypal Image of the Black Virgin.
Always admired her candidness and the ease with which she has introduced presenters when she was part of the program committee. Now she's part of the training program for the Jungian Analysts North Pacific, and her topic tonight is the archetypal image of the Black Virgin. I present to you Marla Herbig.
Thank you. I decided on the way over here, I far prefer introducing speakers to being one of them. In 1967, I went to Iran, and that was where I first experienced, as a good little Protestant, some images of the feminine aspect of the divine. And I remember vividly someone telling me then that if you mess with these dark images of the divine, that all kinds of things can happen to you. And I was still a good little Protestant girl. And I didn't really know what that meant. And it's been interesting to watch it play out in the last week, including right up to the last couple of minutes. And this is my experience with her. Now the book is gone again. Oh, this is so much fun. This book, Longing for Darkness by China Galland, has appeared and reappeared. I literally could not find it in my house this morning. I used it last night at my computer, and I found it this evening in my trunk. So I've sort of come to accept this about her, and I'm not going to argue with her. When I walked in here with slides that were very hard won, I ordered some slides from New York, and they came, and you couldn't tell anything from anything else. And they came on Monday, and I was going to show the slides and give a very abbreviated version of this talk to a group of women therapists, none of whom are Jungian, on Tuesday night. And I think either my cardiovascular system will be healthier after this or my life will be shorter. But I enlisted the help of a friend who's a commercial photographer and took a book that I had bought when I was in Turkey last year, 2 years ago now. And which has some wonderful images. And we decided that this was legal for these purposes. And we took the pictures, and I like them better than what I ordered. So there they were. And I stopped by to get my nephew's boombox tonight because I wanted you to hear Hildegard and someone else later on. And walked in with the slides. And then they went away. And then I went back because I wanted to change them a little bit at the last minute and opened the box and there wasn't anything in the box. And that was really startling because I don't think you can talk about her without images. And I really was trying to figure out how to punt. And I could see Clarice. She said, how long would it take? And I said, it's at least 50 minutes to my house and back. I was thinking, maybe they're home. I don't know. So they're here. I'm happy. And I hope that you will, in the course of this time that we have together, just be real accepting of the fact that we're talking about a mystery. We are not talking about something for which there are easy answers. We are not talking about something that you can actually deal with your logical, rational mind. And as Westerners, we really work against that. But we are talking about something that has come out of the root of human beings since the 25th millennium before Christ. And so our feeble little Western minds will just have to do the best they can. Given that, how do I turn the my sensation function is now gone. Dennis very nicely brought back a reading list, which I created for you and we'll have at the break. Is it focusing itself? There we go. Okay. This is actually the cover of a book by Fred Gustafson called, as you can imagine, The Black Madonna. I'm very intrigued that the original books about the Black Madonna were written by, guess what? Yeah, nice guys. I'm not complaining about them. Because this is a really important piece of this whole issue. The Black Madonna, the Black Virgin, is every bit as important for men as it is for women. This is not a women's issue. This is an issue for all of us as human beings living in a patriarchy. 25,000 years before Christ, in what is now southern Turkey, similar to some figures found in France about 27,000 years before Christ, I do want to say as a disclaimer that there are really, at least Joseph Campbell believes, there are three major areas where civilization as we know it, Western civilization, developed. One was Southeast Asia, about which I know far too little to address. One was the area that I'm going to address, which is really the eastern part of the Mediterranean. This is the area with which the literature about the Black Madonna relates. The third area is in the Americas, a little bit of North America down to Peru. But my references tonight will be to the area that I know a little bit about. Human beings have always pondered the mysteries of death, of birth, of rebirth, of life, the beginning of life. These are quite tiny when I saw them. I had to follow them all over Turkey for 3 weeks. I went to see them in the museum in Ankara, which is the capital, a rather forgettable city, except for the fact that it has a wonderful museum, because it's so Western. And I went down to Çatalhöyük, which is where they were dug up, and there's nothing there but sand anymore, until I spoke a little Turkish, biraz, to the guard. And he was amazed that a Westerner would try to speak a little Turkish. So I was just actually asking where the bathroom was. And so we had a nice conversation. And he took me down past the mound and down some steps and down around a little corner. And there I could see the fragments 26,000 years before Christ. Now 7,000 years before the time of Christ, the actual city of Çatalhöyük was built. And it was built in a very similar pattern to that which the Native American people have in the southwest of the United States. Houses on top of houses on top of houses. With ceremonial prayer centers built right in the middle. You can see from these figures, right there, people are really struggling with and working with the issue of gender and the sacredness of the body. This is just a little reminder that very early on people worshiped trees. This is the tree goddess. Trying to make sense. Science is our modern myth. Then trying to make sense of life and of the sources of life. These are about 17,000 years before Christ. This is woman as she was perceived 7,000 years before the time of Christ. This is the great goddess When you hear about the great goddess, this is Neolithic time. She's giving birth. And she's here with the lions. At that time, there were lions in that part of the world. She was the throne of the world. She was the queen of the earth. Carl Jung talks about the conunctio, mysterium conunctionis. And here we have people struggling with it. Here we have the man and the woman, and then we have the woman with the child. It's about the same period. This is about 50, you know, the dates aren't what you call precise, about 5,700 years before the time of Christ. This was found in a grain bin at Çatalhöyük. When your very life depends on the grain, then you have an attitude of the sacred in the grain. Grain is not just something you go to the store and buy all ground up. Your life depends on that grain. As times passed and people got more sophisticated, whatever that means, we move on. In this case, this is Hecate, the triple goddess. And this theme we're going to explore this evening, which is the goddess as creator, nurturer, and destroyer. Now, you might have some immediate associations with this. They would be incorrect. This is from the region of Cappadocia in Turkey, which is east of where the others were. And she's about 4,000 years before Christ. This is what Carl Jung meant when he talked about an archetype. The feeling that you had in your gut when you experienced this image, that's an archetypal image. I was trying to find all kinds of fancy ways to explain archetypes, and I decided it was better to experience them because that's what they're about. This is the image that is held, it still holds all of us. Now we're going to explore the notion of the virgin. You know, you've noticed that I've used the black virgin, and I'm not, I'm using the word virgin in the traditional sense, which is meaning a woman who is at one with herself. This is not necessarily a sexually inexperienced woman. It's a woman who whose spirit is not owned by anyone, male or female. This is Artemis. And I love, again, how the Western mind works. People call her the mini-breasted goddess. Do you really think those are breasts? They aren't. They're eggs. They're eggs. And Artemis was a more recent version of that early goddess. That sense always of fertility, of the beginning of life, of the gift of life. Isis was, to a lot of people, the first Madonna. This image is referred to by a lot of people as Isis being the first of the Madonnas. And I wanted to read you Joseph Campbell's version of this myth, partly because I had the privilege of hearing him tell it a number of years ago. The first children of the heavenly goddess Nut, her consort Hem, are Isis and Osiris, They are twins. They are husband and wife. The younger brother and sister, Set and Nephthys, also husband and wife. Now, in a famous night, Osiris slept with Nephthys, thinking she was Isis. This is inattention to details, and from things of that kind, bad results can follow. This reminds me of Joe Campbell right there, doesn't it? She bore a child, Anubis, who had the head of a jackal. Set didn't like this, and he planned revenge. He took measurements of Osiris and had a sarcophagus fashioned that would fit him exactly. A jolly party was in full progress when Set comes in and says he has a beautiful sarcophagus and anyone whom it fits can have it. So like Cinderella and the glass slipper, they all try on the sarcophagus. And when Osiris is in it, it fits perfectly. And 72 attendants come rushing in, clamp the lid on the sarcophagus, wrap iron bands around it, and throw it into the Nile. Osiris floats down the Nile and is washed ashore in Syria, and a great tree grows around the sarcophagus. Isis starts out to find her husband. She comes to the place in Syria where Osiris is enclosed in the tree. Meanwhile, the prince of that little town has had a child. A little boy has been born, and the prince has built a palace. The wonderful aroma that comes from this tree has so entranced the prince that he's had the tree cut down, what a good Westerner, and made it into a pillar in the palace. So Osiris is in the palace inside a pillar. Isis is sitting by the well where the young women from the palace come to draw water, and they invite this beautiful older woman in to become nurse for the newborn little prince. She accepts the job and nurses the child from her little finger. Goddesses can stoop only so far, Campbell says. At night, to give the child immortality, Isis places him in the fireplace and recites her charms. The fire is supposed to burn off his mortal character and turn him into an immortal. Meanwhile, she turns into a swallow and, twittering mournfully, flies around the pillar. Well, one evening, the little boy's mother happens to break in on this scene, and you can imagine she lets out a scream. There's her baby in the fireplace and nobody watching him. There's just a funny twittering swallow flying around a post. And the child has to be rescued from the fire because the spell is broken, and the swallow turns into the beautiful nursemaid. So Isis explains the situation as well as she can. And then she says, by the way, my husband's in that pillar. Could you please give me the pillar so I can take my husband home? And the king, very polite, says, here you are, my darling. The pillar's put on a barge, and on the way back to the papyrus swamp, Isis takes off the sarcophagus lid, lies upon the dead Osiris, and conceives Horus. That's Horus. Now, Osiris has two sons. One by Nephthys, Anubis, the jackal boy, and another by Isis, Horus. Isis is afraid to go back to the palace because Set has assumed the throne. She goes into the papyrus swamp and gives birth to Horus. The gods Amon and Thoth come to assist her. Meanwhile, Set, who is out hunting, follows a boar into the papyrus swamp and finds Isis with Osiris's corpse beside her. In a rage, he tears Osiris into 15 pieces, scatters the 15 pieces over the landscape, and poor Isis has to go hunt for him again. She's helped now by Nephthys and Anubis, who sniffs around the jackal boy. Sniffs around, and they find 14 of the pieces. The dead Osiris is associated with the rising of the Nile, which fertilizes Egypt. And the juices of Osiris's disintegrating body are identified with the waters of the Nile. It is he, therefore, who is the fertilizing force of Egypt. The 14 pieces are put together, and Anubis, in the role later assumed by the priests, embalms Osiris. The missing piece, the genital organs, have been swallowed by a fish. Campbell says, this is the origin of the fish meal on Fridays. It's a sacramental consuming of the sacred flesh. Now, you hear in that story some rather familiar pieces and some startling ones. The next Madonna I'd like to talk about was an unexpected one for me, and I've since read several accounts by other good little Protestant girls. I was raised with this Mary, who we heard about at Easter, you know, whatever that time was, Christmas. And if you were good, you got to be Mary in the Christmas play, right? And because that was the good role. And I didn't know much more about her than that, except she was just kind of this compliant woman. And I didn't like that particularly. But I was told that that was the way to be a woman, that this was the ideal of womanhood, was to be like Mary, you know, to be this unwed mother and do what somebody told you to do. And as my mother would attest, that doesn't quite suit my nature. And I really, truly didn't have any perception of Mary much other than that until I started working as a therapist 25 years ago. And then all these clients would come in who were raised Catholic, and they had a relationship with Mary. Conflictual very often, but they had a relationship with Mary. And it was just kind of fascinating to me. So as a good clinician, if I didn't know about something, I went out and learned the facts about that. And I would not say that I had experienced the archetype of Mary at all in that process, but I had learned the facts. And over the years, I've had various sort of brushes with Mary. But when I was in Israel, I was in Iran in 1967. And after I left there, went to Israel. And, sounds like this week. I had this money that my mother was to wire me when I was done in Iran. I'd been there 4 months, and I was going to go to Israel and Greece on the way home. And mother wired me this money, and guess what? I never got it. So I got to Israel, and I didn't have very much money. And I had a plane ticket back to Athens, and then I had a boat ticket back from Athens. But I had a month to kill, and I had, as I remember quite distinctly, under $50. And so, and I was traveling with, there were 10 of us who were college students doing this thing. And one of the people with whom I traveled is now, she's a jazz singer, mostly in Belgium. And Dee was in a similar predicament, having spent all of her money. And I couldn't loan her anymore because I didn't have any. So we discovered that you could eat bread and cheese for a while. And then we decided to see if we could make a little money. So we went to this Palestinian hotel and convinced the guy that it would be really nice to have a little music in the restaurant at dinner time, and if we could just have dinner. And that happened. It was great. And we got to know the staff. We'd show up at dinner time, and then it was so great because the cook would make up these little care packages with bread and cheese and fruit for the morning, and that's what we would eat. And then we would go off and explore. Well, if the chauffeur wasn't busy, if he didn't have people from the hotel to take places, then he would take us places. So he took us to the Dead Sea, and he took us here and there. And because I was raised Presbyterian, I knew those places. So we could really, you know, I knew about them, and he was kind of intrigued by that, and that was great fun. And then he asked if we wanted to see where Jesus and Mary had been. Well, Dee had been raised Southern Baptist. And he was intrigued by her, by the way, because she's black. And she's very tall and black and quite striking and has a voice that just makes everyone else stop singing who's around her. And so the chauffeur would drive farther if Dee would sing in the car. And so I'd give her my bread if she'd sing. And so one day the chauffeur said he would take us. And then as she's singing and we're talking, and the chauffeur is saying to me, you know, we were speaking this funny, I was mostly speaking Persian at the time, and he didn't speak any of that, but he didn't speak very good English, but we managed. And He took us to this great big church, and then he took us inside the church, and then he took us down the stairs. You know those stories, down the stairs and around you go, down to the bottom, and then you go through these other doors. And every time you're going through the Catholic part and the Assyrian part and the Aramaic part and the, I don't know, everybody had some claim on this ground. And we went down below, and he turned around to Dee, and he told her to sing. So she did. And I had this sense at that moment that Mary really was a person. It was the first time for me. So a couple of years, 2 years ago, at Easter time, I went to Turkey. And this group had been together for a couple of weeks, and we were on a tour of sacred sites in Turkey, and we had a really interesting time of it. And I dragged them all down to Çatalhöyük, and it was dusty. It took 3.5 hours in this bus. And it was dusty when we got there, and they're like, Marla, there's nothing to see. It's all in the museum. So the way they got their part with me was they all wanted to go see Mary's house, the home of Mary. And I wasn't particularly enthusiastic, but I'd gotten what I wanted, so we all got one thing. So it turns out, you know, the first Christian church was in Ephesus. It wasn't in Jerusalem. The Christians got out of Jerusalem, and St. John went to Ephesus, and that is the site of the first Christian church. And it's generally accepted. On the cross, Jesus said to John, Son, behold thy mother. And he said to Mary, Mother, behold thy son. So it's generally accepted. It's not totally proved that Mary indeed went to Ephesus, where probably she studied again with a mystery school of which she had been a part. Probably the Essenes. Well, I don't remember the date. It was, I think, in the 1700s. It was a while ago. A woman in Germany, a nun who'd never left Germany, had a vision of Mary and the home of Mary. And she drew this vision, and it was a protracted vision. She drew the foundation of the house and all kinds of things. And she was adamant that it was on a mound looking above Ephesus, looking down on Ephesus. Well, nobody knew where Mary had ended up. And ultimately, some German industrialists, they have been very good at funding archaeological discoveries, paid for this excavation of this mound up on a hill above Ephesus, and here was the foundation of this house, just as this nun had in her vision. And this mark here, there's a red mark on the side of the walls, that's the foundation that was there, and it was precisely as she had seen it, covered with years of dirt. I mean, as high as that hill is up there. So we're in the bus, and we're going to go to Ephesus, and I'm excited about going to Ephesus, and we're going to stop at Mary's house, and I'm hoping we won't be there too long. And I have to admit it. I was kind of, okay, but, you know, I really want to go to Ephesus and see all this Artemis stuff. And the bus stopped, and everybody got out, and everybody was chattering about, now, what's the word for bathroom? What's the bathroom word for women? And stuff, the usual things. And there was this little gate, and I walked through the gate. And I simply was in the most peaceful place I have ever been in my life. It's full of little tiny birds, similar to our chickadees, all chirping and singing, and there's this house. And so I went in, and went into the house. And this is the best I can do to show you. You go into this little house, and there, is that focus for you?
There
she is. Well, I'd heard the phrase Black Madonna, but I didn't get it. Now, I'd been seeing some pretty old stuff, and none of it was that black. And this one is very much this color, and she's outside. At this site, as is true of many sites of the Black Madonnas, and certainly some non-Black Madonnas, some paler Madonnas, there's water that's reputed to be miraculous water, and There were some crutches left there and things like that. This is a site venerated by both Christians and by Muslims because they respect Mary as the mother of one of the prophets. So my interest in the Black Madonna intensified. Now, I went to Zurich last August. And by now, I was not a complete fool. I was going to check out this Black Madonna that I heard about in Zurich. And what I really wasn't prepared for, I was busy reading about some other things I was hoping to do while I was there. And it was my first trip to Europe, so I, of course, had about, being an extroverted intuitive, I had about 507 days worth of things to do. And in my 2 weeks. So I was really focused on Hildegard of Bingen and wanting to go to Bingen and reading about Hildegard, and I did go to Hildegard's church. That's another story. And my nephew's wife, who has never gone to church, was asking me about various things about what I was going to see and why, who's Hildegard and why was I interested in Hildegard. And then what was this Black Madonna thing I was mentioning? And she took me to Cologne, and we went in the dome, the great big cathedral, which was very impressive and nice. And then we went into a little, one of the little Romanesque churches in Cologne, and there was a Black Madonna. And we both gasped, and we were hooked. It was a very marvelous experience. Well, the first morning I got to Zurich, I took an overnight train from Koblenz to Zurich. I don't recommend it. I got on the train at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I they don't turn the lights on. And I had the upper bunk. And I'm relatively limber, and getting up on that bunk in the middle of the night and not stepping on the man below me was quite interesting. So I got up there, and I had a rather sleepless night because there's nothing to stop you from falling off. And but that was fine. And so I got to Zurich at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I couldn't get into my pension until the afternoon. So I thought, well, it's Sunday morning. I think I'll go out and see this Black Madonna. So I got on a train, and the Swiss trains, of course, are wonderful. And I went out to Einsiedeln, which is not too far. And forgive me, Peter, if I'm saying it incorrectly. It's not too far from Zurich. It's a beautiful ride. It was a beautiful morning and a beautiful ride. And this is very much what it looks like. Now, I had been at that point in a number. My nephew says it was 105, but I think it was only about 30 churches. And I was unprepared for the interior of this church. Yeah. It's the most feminine church I've ever been in. I don't know how well you look upside down. Mostly I wanted you to see the color anyway. I did. Okay, focus on the color. Go with the mystery of the color, okay? Because none of the details matter anyway. This is, you know, when you're looking at the front of the church where it was all white, this is one of those, I don't know what they call them, the parts, naves, thank you, that go off to the sides. This exuberance of color and richness and femininity. This is the only... I just didn't feel right taking pictures in there. It just, you know, didn't feel right to me. So I made do with booklets and things. So this was where you walk in here, okay? And then, but it's never this empty. And all of that stuff you saw is back here. And here is this. And there are many stories about this chapel. But and after the break, we'll talk about some of the specifics. But the gist of it is that inside of this little chapel, which has been rebuilt and rebuilt and rebuilt, we're going to look right here now. And the priests change her clothes according to the seasons and the particular church calendar. Keep that in mind when we talk about Inanna. This is at Chartres. Now, you know, for those of us who are not Catholic, those of you who are Catholic, this is old, you know, a lot of this you know, but for those of us who don't, the reason they call churches Notre Dame, you know what, do you know what that means? Yeah. Well, I'd never put that together, actually, till this trip.
What does it mean?
Right. Now, when I went to Chartres, which is... about an hour and a half out of Paris by train. Marvelous experience. And a marvelous cathedral with just remarkable windows and everything. I had heard that if you went to the Catholic bookstore and if you said the right things, that you might be able, maybe, to get a tour down to the crypt underneath the cathedral. And I circled it for a long time. I'm relatively brave, but I had so much fear about it. Ultimately, I went over to the bookstore, and three times I got rebuffed. Oh, the tour just started too late. Oh, the tour just started too late. And then I ran into Donald Sandner, whom some of you heard, and he and his wife were there and back in the cathedral, and I said, hey, Don, have you ever been down... in the crypt? No, I didn't know you could go. Well, that's all I needed, right? Because then I could do this for somebody else. So I went back to the Catholic bookstore and said, now, I need three of us. We need to go. And she looked at me and she said, you don't give up, do you? I said, no, I'm not going to. I said, I'm really going to stand here until we can go in. And she said, well, the last tour is starting in 5 minutes. So I went off at a sprint and found Don, who does not walk very quickly, and his wife, and we went downstairs. And she's down, you go down, and you go down, and it gets danker and damper and darker, and they keep closing these doors behind you. And there she is. Now, this is just one of the ones I happened to cross. I actually don't know where I took it. But I wanted you to get these images in you of these various black Madonnas. This is again at Chartres. Sorry, that was out of sequence. Aha. Now, we have another black virgin. Kali. And Kali's story is as follows. I think I'll read to you, but actually someone wrote to her. By you this universe is born. By you this world is created. By you it is protected, O Devi. By you it is consumed at the end. You who are eternally the form of the whole world, at the time of creation, you are the form of the creative force. At the time of preservation, you are the form of that protective power. And at the time of the dissolution of the world, you are the form of the destructive power. You are the supreme knowledge as well as ignorance, intellect, and contemplation. Western mind has little trouble with all those opposites. The Indo-European mind does not. Over and over again, as I read about the dichotomy between the black Madonna and the more typical Madonna images, I would find references to the Indo-European mind, Indo-Europeans being primarily people from India, being able to tolerate the dualities, the multivalent experience. For a long time, brutal demonic forces had been dominating and oppressing the world. Even the powerful gods were helpless and suffered defeat at their hands. They fled pell-mell in utter humiliation, a state hardly fit for the divine. Finally, they prayed in desperation to the daughter of the Himalayas to save gods and men alike. The gods sent forth their energies as streams of fire, and from these energies emerged the great goddess Durga. In the great battle to destroy the most arrogant and truculent man-beasts, the goddess Kali sprang forth from the brow of Durga to join in the fierce fighting. As the forceful aspect of Durga, Kali has been dubbed horrific or terrible in masculine-based commentaries, without understanding of the episode's inner meaning, the challenge of the feminine force. What is there in the story of Durga for us, writes Leonie Caldicott in The Dance of the Woman Warrior? Well, to start with, the fact that the gods could not change their situation themselves, and they had to create a goddess, not another god, to do it for them. In a deadlocked situation, the woman is the only moving element. Another thing worth noting is that the dualism, gods, anti-gods, good, evil, has a lot to do with the deadlock. A fact which is far from irrelevant to Cold Wars, with which military powers play today. That dualism also makes a point of keeping women in their place, making the female condition the undesirable half of the dualistic equation. The only way Durga can alter the consequences of this division is by employing an adaptability not normally available under the dualistic regime. Durga's name means beyond reach. This is an echo of the woman warrior's fierce virginal autonomy. Part of the reach she puts herself beyond so adamantly is the reach of society's attempt to describe her to herself. The more repressive the images available to women, the more the virgin condition becomes a defense against these. She's called the Dark Mother or the Hindu Triple Goddess. She's the goddess of creation, preservation, and destruction. Because in a very profound way, life and birth have always been bound up with death and destruction. Kali was an archetypal image, still is. She is the one, many, many people say this is the one live image today of the birth and death mother, simultaneously the womb and the tomb, giver of life and devourer of her children. The same image portrayed in 1,000 ancient religions. It seems the image of the angry, punishing, castrating father is somehow less threatening than that of the destructive mother. Perhaps because she symbolized the inexorable reality of death, whereas he only postulated a problematic postmortem judgment. Tantric worshippers of Kali thought it essential to face her curse, the terror of death, as willingly as they accepted blessings from her beautiful, nurturing, maternal aspect. For them, wisdom meant learning that no coin has only one side. As death can't exist without life, so also life can't exist without death. Kali's sages communed with her in the grisly atmosphere of the cremation ground to become familiar with the images of death. Kali stood for existence, which meant becoming, because all her world was an eternal living flux from which all things rose and disappeared again in endless cycles. The gods whom she bore and devoured addressed her this way. Thou art the original of all the manifestations. Thou art the birthplace of even us. Thou knowest the whole world, yet none know thee. Thou art both subtle and gross, manifested and veiled, formless yet with form. Who can understand thee? It is thou who art the supreme primordial Kalika. Resuming after dissolution thine own form, dark and formless, thou alone remainest as one ineffable and inconceivable. Though thyself without beginning, multiform by the power of Maya, thou art the beginning of all, creatrix, protectress, and destructress. When you get in a vehicle and leave the San Francisco airport, this is who greets you. This is a Bufano sculpture. Now, I spent an hour and 45 minutes in the San Francisco airport yesterday trying to find an image of this. I took this out of Gustavus's book, The Black Madonna, and I wanted a better picture for you. And there isn't one to be found in the airport. And I had the most entertaining discussions with the security police, who were all people of color. We had this great conversation about you mean the black lady with the big tits? And one of them said, we had great discussions. We had very great discussions. And they tried. They called all kinds of people, and they were trying, you know. And nobody, there's not a postcard with her on it. She's huge. I don't know how many feet tall she is. Numbers are not in my realm of reasoning. I want to say more than a story tall. She's really tall. And she's right there on the grass. They're doing some construction around her. I first noticed her just sort of by accident once on the shuttle, and I asked the shuttle driver what that was, and he says, "Oh, that missile?"
It's interesting, the overall shape is almost flat.
Yeah. Then we'll come back and talk about, we'll answer questions, and then I'd like to tell you some of the stories. Go with some of these people. Thank you. What? Yeah. That's fine. Leave it there. Yes. Okay. Okay. Let's do it. I've just had a request that we sing a song to the Black Goddess, so we're going to.
Would you start it? Holly?
Okay. Yeah. Do any of the rest of you want to try it? All right, let's do it. We'll do it. You sing it one more time, and then we'll all sing once. Okay. Read you some of the 5,000 quotes I have for you. It's terrible. I was in San Francisco yesterday, and I found some books that I didn't have time to put on the reading list because I got back late. This one's called Mystery Religions in the Ancient World, and it's interesting little book. And it says, a desire for the truth, especially about the gods, is in reality a yearning for the deity. For the study and the search is a reception, as it were, of things sacred. An occupation more pious than any practice of abstinence or service in a temple, but particularly well-pleasing to this goddess, Isis, whom you worship, for she is both exceedingly wise and a lover of worship. Part of my thoughts about this whole Black Madonna question have come from a number of fortunate years through the Jung Society of listening to Stefan Heller. And I think some of you are familiar with Stefan Heller. He's the bishop of the Gnostic Church in Los Angeles, and he's written The Gnostic Jung and Seven Sermons to the Dead, and thank you, some very interesting books. And he happens to be coming to the Theosophical Society in April. And the flyers are out there.
By Doug. Yeah.
Great. He's going to be talking on the Gospel of Thomas. Oh, I didn't know he was going to do this. Okay. What he's going to do is the Hymn of the Pearl. And he's calling it an entry point into the gospel, according to St. Thomas. Well, this whole evening is really about membering and dismembering and remembering. And that's what the Hymn of the Pearl is all about. For those of you who are familiar with it, the punchline is, I've left my heavenly parents, and I'm in Egypt, which was the Aurora Avenue North of the times, and I've forgotten who I am and who my parents are and why I'm there, and a dove comes from my parents, and the dove says to me, remember who you are. Remember who you are. And everything changes after that. And I think that this is what early peoples were really working with, was this question about who are we, how do we fit in to the cosmic order, how does the masculine and the feminine, what are their roles? There's some really, I think, profound ignorance that we have living as we do where we go to grocery stores and things, and where we have roofs over our head unless we have floods or tornadoes, what it meant to absolutely, truly be at the mercy of the elements all the time, and to be really tied in with the seasons in a true sense, that they're in the drought and in the dead of winter, there's no food. There are no oranges from Florida on the train. You know? There's just, and that sense of the cycles, and the mystery of why are people born? You know that soft porn film, Blue Lagoon, with, what's her name, the model with the eyebrows? Thank you. You know, I mean, really, I think that I recently watched that. My 17-year-old nephew, whose boombox says Puke FM on it, is trying to get me to be in the contemporary world. And so he thought I should see Blue Lagoon. So I did. And I said to him, Nigel, this is the ultimate question. I said, oh, Marla, I thought it was just money. So, but it's true, because there they are, trying to figure out, the two of them, these two young people, you know, stuck on this island and trying to figure out what their attraction to one another is. And then he says to her, why did you have a baby? She says, I don't know. Right? And people were trying to make sense of things. Now, there's some interesting stuff that's come out recently that's fascinating about this thing about the goddess and the bull. And it was a book that was in the reserve section, and I the library was closing, and many, many things were happening in San Francisco, so I didn't get a photocopy of it. But a modern physician has shown that the way the horns of the bull are shaped, and the way they shaped the horns of the bull with the ancient goddess is anatomically the way the woman's fallopian tubes are and her uterus is. And, you know, it's so funny because we have this tendency to think, well, but they didn't have proper dissection tools. Well, they had a lot of time. And the thing that, they had millennia, the thing that the people in this part of the world had was obsidian. This is the beginning of the darkness. This is what the people in Anatolia traded, was obsidian. They knew all about darkness. Ishtar and Cybele came from meteorites. You know, this black meteorite landed on Crete or Sicily and became the goddess. And in the darkness, we are reflected. Now, the poets often figure out things that we who like to think about psychology don't get to. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Spanish poet Lorca. In his four talks on the theory and function of the... Oh, dear. Does anybody know how to pronounce it? Thank you. He says the duende is the sense of the presence of death. And he says, all that has black sounds has duende. These black sounds are the mystery, the roots fastened in the mire that we all know and all ignore, the mire that gives us the very substance of art. He says, the duende climbs up inside you from the soles of the feet. It is the spirit of the earth. Where the angel dazzles and the muse dictates, the duende baptizes in dark water, scattering green anemones of phosphorus on the river of the night. Like Jacob's angel, the duende must be wrestled with. Duende and many poets of this century who write in Spanish, Pablo Neruda and Antonio Machado, they have a real concern about death. And out of this concern, there's a real vibrant life force and a wild and beautiful imagination. One of them said, where there is no imagination of death, there is no death. There is a death of the imagination. Let me say that again. Where there is no imagination of death, there is a death of the imagination. Tibetan lamas have whole practices of meditating on death because meditation on death brings clarity and precision of being. It recalls us to the poignancy of this moment, which will never happen again, this precious moment. The awareness that all life is like the taste of honey on a razor blade. It's a good story, but I'm not going to tell it to you. Noel Cobb wrote a neat little book, and he says that the angel of imagination, though its body may be formed of the most elusive twilight, flies on two wings, one of brilliant day and one of blackest night. Poetry cannot fly with only one wing, and living poetry has its roots in the awareness of the presence of death. Carl Jung says, one does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. And Neruda says, there are cemeteries that are lonely, graves full of bones that do not make a sound, the heart moving through a tunnel, in it darkness, darkness, darkness. Like a shipwreck, we die going into ourselves, as though we were drowning inside our hearts, as though we lived falling out of the skin into the soul. And I know David is going to get you really into the soul in a couple of weeks. Now, Francis Thompson said in Ode to the Setting Sun, for birth hath in itself the germ of death, but death hath in itself the germ of birth. It is the falling acorn buds the tree, the falling rain that bears the greenery. The fern plants molder when the ferns arise, for there is nothing lives but something dies. And there is nothing dies, but something lives, till skies be fugitives. Till time, the hidden root of change, updries, are birth and death inseparable on earth. For they are twain yet one, and death is birth. a little contrary to some of the Western notions of conquering death. But when you were at this time and for many generations, well, I think they should have some lights, Lucretia. Thank you. I know you can't see them as well, but you saw them before, and I just wanted to see them, just to mentally have them back there. It's the darkness and the light. I mean, this is, if there's anything that Carl Jung really, really holds steady to, it's living with the tension of the opposites. And the tension is not us standing still. I have these great photographs that Rick took of a high wire artist at the Cirque du Soleil. And they show so beautifully what happens, because when she is standing on the wire, she's not just standing there whistling Dixie, is she? She's moving like mad. But because he had some kind of a strobe thing or something fancy, it stopped her, you know, in movement. And so you can see the fluttering of her arms. And she always has two points on her body that are perfectly still. So it'll be one toe, essentially, and maybe the top of her head, or maybe the arm that's up, will be perfectly still at that moment in time, and the rest is flapping like mad. And that is living with the tension of the opposites. I think that that's the struggle that these dark goddesses can bring us. We have at this time, at about, I tried to do you a family tree, and it was worse than trying to do my own. You know, because everybody's related to somebody, and it moved all over the place. And is there anybody who's not sort of basically familiar with the Mediterranean area, just sort of in general? I brought a map, if anybody wants to see it. But what we had, if... This is Italy, okay? Here's Italy, and here is the Atlantic Ocean. And here's the African continent. And so Sicily would be right in there somewhere? Okay. So, and here's Greece, and there's Turkey, and there's Syria, and this is where the Sumerians were, and the Babylonians were, and all that. All right, how's that? Well, hello. Okay. That's a nice sign. What we had was, we had Isis down here on the African continent, okay? And she sometimes was called the Ethiopian. I mean, it wasn't what we, you know, the Western world did after some wars and divide the African continent up into these artificial boundaries. You had Sicily and Crete, a lot, though Sicily, where the sailors stopped in all of these journeys to get obsidian, to get trees, to get all of these trade routes. And so there was always this cross-pollination that went on about religions. And so you can have the Babylonians calling someone Ishtar and Sumerians calling her Inanna, for example. And it isn't that sense of it's just one individual person or image. It's truly an archetypal image, something that's very alive and grows. Now, Joseph Henderson talks about what he calls the cultural unconscious. Jung talked a lot about the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious, that really overarching repository of images and experiences. But Joseph Henderson talks a lot in his Thresholds of Initiation about, and in person, he says, I wrote that 20 years ago, and I still believe it. He's 90 years old. He still believes what he wrote 20 years ago. He's thought about it quite a bit since then. And so that you can have a strong cultural influences that make the story different. And the other awareness that I've developed in looking at some of this material is that what we're looking at is words on paper that were passed down in an oral tradition, or were passed down in a pictorial tradition. And then we say, well, why do they say black instead of dark? Well, they probably didn't say either of those words. You know, we can get hung up on one word being, I think, far too symbolic, when we really ought to be more interested in the felt sense of it and the experience of it. Now, we have these goddesses. The Sumerian goddess was called Inanna, and she was called the Queen of Heaven. She was called the Queen of the Universe, the Queen who encompasses the universe. One of the hymns of praise to Inanna is, O my Queen, Queen of the Universe, the Queen who encompasses the universe, may the King enjoy long days at your holy lap. Well, if you have a lap like this, okay, I mean, we're talking a lap. That true sense of being contained and really having enough. Well, I toyed with whether I would tell you these whole stories and decided against it, but some of you are familiar with Dan Wolkstein's work, and the Jung Society brought her to Seattle a long time ago when she actually had first come out with this book. And the whole story of the Inanna story is about 7,000 years, 9,000 years old, rather. Again, like the Isis story, it's the story of this virgin who, in this case, who chooses her husband. And in some versions of it, he's also her brother. And that's we're talking the twin motif. We're not necessarily speaking actual physical incest here. We're talking about a motif, her opposite. Okay? And if you take this story as being all about parts of you, okay? So she chooses her husband. And that long ago, she's choosing her husband. She turns down somebody who really wants to marry, and she chooses somebody she wants to be with. And then her older sister is in the underworld. And she wants to go visit her older sister. Now, I'm a younger sister, and I can understand that impulse. And if my older sister told me to get down there, I probably would do it, right? She wants to go visit her older sister. But if you take that again as a part of your own personality, what is that? The part that's more experienced, that knows. That's what we younger sisters always thought of our older sisters. They know. My sister did. And so she wants to go down there. She uses more as the excuse, the political statement, she's going to go to somebody's funeral. People use that now to get out of work, I think. But she goes down there. Now, in order to get down there, she has to go through several levels, and at each level, she has to get rid of one piece of her clothing to go, until by the time she's down there, she's stark naked. And she didn't really want to do that. She was Inanna was an adolescent. She didn't really like giving up her clothes. And then there's an adventure, there's a task, there's something to be accomplished. She does all of that, and as she comes back up at each layer, she gets part of her clothes back. The story of Ishtar and Attis is similar. Again, and Ishtar marries her son. Okay? And again, there's a descent. There's always this descent, which we Westerners just hate so much. There's this descent. There's a task. There's something to be accomplished. And then there's coming back up with something new. Always with something new. There's something, there's a germ, something generative that we come back up with. Isis seeking out the pieces of Osiris. Right? And changing herself to look like somebody who could be a nursemaid for a prince. Taking off her queenly robes and putting on the common robes in order to enter into that place. And several people asked me at the break if I was ever going to go into any one of these in any detail, and that tickled me because Susan Riley and I have talked about this because it's so huge. It's just so huge. And this was the comforting thing in this book, Longing for Darkness, because China Gallant is interviewing somebody who knows everything, you know, the thinking type. He must be thinking in sensation, and he knows all the history and all the stories and who's related to whom, and he keeps saying, this is very complicated. This is very complicated. And at the point at which I was reading that for the third time, I thought, you are not kidding. So, and it was also comforting to me because I'm like, whoa, this is very complicated. So Susan and I were toying with something, which is that we're thinking this summer we might on some Sunday morning devote some time to each one of these images. So if you want to know about that, you can, Susan will what? You have any paper? Okay. Susan, you just put it on the table and we could, if you want us to let you know. Because I'm kind of eager to go into depth with these folks. Now, what, we have all these varied images, and how do they all tie in? Well, we had the Mediterranean here area, right? But we didn't talk about what was clear up in what is now Britain and Ireland, which are the Celtic peoples. They were up there doing their thing. Actually, the Celts moved down through Turkey. They moved all over the place. And they had a number of sites that were very sacred to them. And people who are into ley lines, you know, they figure out all these highly charged areas on the planet. I confess I don't know any more about it than that. People who are into sacred geometry, that fits with where a lot of the Druid sites were. Well, one of the ways to conquer people is to incorporate whatever they hold to be precious. Or you can do what China has done in Tibet, which is try to destroy it. So you either destroy it, which has happened in a lot of religion movements in the country, or you can incorporate it. Well, at these very, very ancient sites then that the Druids had worshipped at, and they hadn't erected large facades. They had simply been with the place and the feeling, the energy, the experience of the place. Those often are sites where there are black Madonnas now. And Chartres is a prime example of that. Chartres is on the site of an ancient Druid site. Okay? And I've heard from a number of people, including Malcolm Miller, the guy who gives the tours at Chartres. What a kick. That the Catholic Church spends a lot of energy making sure that no one excavates that site. Now, I'm not disparaging the Catholic Church. I'm just quoting Malcolm. You know, we have in the Western world a lot of discomfort with the idea of getting in touch with stuff that's outside of our own kind of logos thinking approach. Pardon? Chartres Cathedral, which is outside of, it's outside of Paris and south a little bit. So this, the question then about why are these images dark? Why are there some black Madonnas? I think you just have to look at, across all the images. The thing that they all share, if you look at Isis and you think about all the others, they were all physically beautiful according to their milieu. So here we have quite a slender woman. Okay, fit right in with this society's definition. At Chalhyuk, we had a whole other experience, and Nana is presented as having a big belly and big breasts and big hips and thighs. Her thighs are just glorified in the book. Okay, so it's very much, again, that's what Joseph Henderson talks about, the cultural unconscious. They were all virgins in that true sense of the word virgin, meaning belonging to no man, or one in herself, or one alone in herself. It does, to be virgin in that meaning does not mean to be chaste, but rather to be true to nature and to instinct. So in Ishtar's realm, wild animals roam free. When we talk about a virgin forest, we don't mean one that's unfertilized or barren, do we? We mean one that we haven't taken a chainsaw to. A place that's particularly fruitful and that has multiplied because it's taken life into itself and transformed it. That's what the forests can do when they're left to their natural cycle. Giving birth naturally, taking things, dead things back. So we talk about nurse trees in the forest. The virgin acts according to her own nature. She may give herself to many lovers, but like the moon, she can never be possessed. She's not the counterpart to a male deity, but she's rather a goddess in her own right. Okay? She can be in relationship with her divine son or somebody, but that's not her identity. Her identity is as herself. Her psychological development is not based on relationship to the male. She's quite independent of him. And on the reading list, I just forgot her first name, Yulinov. Anne, thank you. And write some interesting things about that. Now, I did want to say some, because I'm a Jungian, I believe the opposite's always true. So I wanted to talk just a little bit about the negative expression of the virgin archetype, because we kind of hear this glorification of it, okay? Well, domination by the virgin archetype can constellate a pre-masculine orientation, where a woman can really stay contained in a mother-daughter relationship, and she's never penetrated nor awakened to her deepest feminine self. This can produce an identity where a woman takes over collective masculine values, reducing her persona to a virile woman while avoiding relationship with the animus and its spiritual elements. While being outwardly energetic and dedicated to a cause, such a woman remains inwardly passive or without ideas or initiatives of her own. Does that make sense? She can look real active, but it's all reactive. It's all, yeah. Another type of negative identity may be that of the cold woman, whose sexuality is repressed or it's pressed into the service of her ego. So sexuality then manifests itself as power, which is not what these virgins were about either, not sheer power for the sake of power, either in autonomous outbursts or in manipulations of a partner simply to further her own ambitions. Her feeling function remains undeveloped, and she herself remains untouched and basically unevolved, a person in her own right but isolated. And that's a different thing. That's a very different thing. We're not talking uninvolved here. She's finding parts of him all over the place. She's flying around like a swallow. I mean, she's related. Okay?
In the mud in the Nile.
That's right. In the swamp, in the papyrus swamp. So. Now, I think that what happened was, and it's not, this is just Herbig's theorem, but a lot of other people have some similar thoughts, that the power and the reality of Mary got purified and whitewashed, okay, and it got real polarized. And for a lot of women, I mean, I said that jokingly, but I really do believe that for a lot of women, their notion was they were supposed to be like Mary. Right? You know, it's always sort of funny because there's a lot of people still say that Mary, she was a virgin when she had Christ, and then she was a virgin again. But she had a couple more kids, you know. That's a little tricky. And she was, you know. So, it's fun to come to it as a non-Catholic because you're going, what? Wait a minute. So the power and the passion all got shunted off. You don't hear anything about the power and the passion of Mary in that whitewashed version. But when you come face to face with this black Madonna, just in and of itself, you begin to have some experience of her. I work quite a bit with people who have terminal illnesses or life-threatening conditions, and I worked with a woman who was raised as a Mennonite, and in a form where sexuality is very repressed and denied, and it's very fundamentalist. And she had very intellectually worked out her very impending death. There was nothing to do medically for the fact she was going to die very soon. And I began to have nightmares. I often have dreams when clients are about to die that sort of get me ready, I think, get my psyche ready for this. But I began to have nightmares of her being pursued by this black woman that I decided later was Kali. And so I just began to explore this with her without telling her I was having nightmares, and just exploring what she felt pursued by. And then one day we did an active imagination, which is something that Jung taught, and she, in the room, became aware that she was really resisting something. And then she really had this sense of being pursued by the black woman. She was really panicky, and I was sitting there not wanting her heart rate to get too high, you know. Never had someone expire in my office before. And, you know, not wanting to put my own experience onto her either. And I asked her to turn around and face it. And when she did, it was the Black Madonna. And what that Black Madonna said is so similar to something that I found where the Sufi angel Madonna Intelligenza says, "Dearly beloved, I have called you so often, and you have not heard me. I have shown myself to you so often, and you have not seen me. I have made myself fragrant so often, and you have not smelled me. Why? Before my visible form, you flee into the invisible, but truly my hearth and swelling are in the invisible. Look well, for I am the new moon. Image in your heart." And the next 2 weeks of her death process were very different for her. And I quit having nightmares. When we talk about the Madonna, I wanted to, you know, what's her name? Anne Levertov. See, I have no names tonight. Wrote this wonderful poem called The Annunciation. We know the scene, the room, variously furnished, almost always a lectern, a book, always the tall lily. Arrived on solemn grandeur of great wings, the angelic ambassador, standing or hovering, whom she acknowledges, a guest. But we are told of meek obedience. No one mentions courage. The engendering spirit did not enter her without consent. God waited. She was free to accept or to refuse. Choice integral to humanness. Aren't there annunciations of one sort or another in most lives? Some unwillingly undertake great destinies, enact them in sullen pride, uncomprehending. More often, those moments when roads of light and storm open from darkness in a man or woman are turned away from in dread, in a wave of weakness, in despair, and with relief. Ordinary lives continue. God does not smite them, but the gates close. The pathway vanishes. She had been a child who played, ate, slept like any other child, but unlike others, wept only for pity, laughed in joy, not triumph. Compassion and intelligence fused in her, indivisible. Called to a destiny more momentous than any in all of time, she did not quail, only asked a simple, "How can this be?" And gravely, courteously, took to heart the angel's reply, perceiving instantly the astounding ministry she was offered, to bear in her womb infinite weight and lightness, to carry in hidden, finite inwardness 9 months of eternity, to contain in slender vase of being the sum of power, in narrow flesh the sum of light, then bring to birth, push out into air, a man-child needing like any other milk and love, but who was God. This was the moment no one speaks of, when she could still refuse. A breath unbreathed, spirit suspended, waiting. She did not cry, "I cannot, I am not worthy, nor I have not the strength." She did not submit with gritted teeth, raging, coerced. Bravest of all humans, consent illumined her. The room filled with its light, the lily glowed in it, and the iridescent wings. Consent, courage unparalleled, opened her utterly. Denise, thank you. Yes, I'm just... That, I would propose, is the archetype of the Black Madonna. The passion and the compassion. I have something I'd like you to hear before you leave. This is Bobby McFerrin.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.